It is an economics explainer here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and lots of ground to cover, starting with oil. The U.S. is now the top producer of crude oil in the world. What do you want to know about what that means for our economy, what that means for world markets, and how do those world markets work anyway? We're at 800-642-1234 with your questions. And then the Middle East. President Trump announced new sanctions on Iran this week. It comes on top of sanctions imposed in April to cut off all international sales of Iran's oil. So what will these new sanctions do to the price of oil? And what can we learn from the 1973 Arab oil embargo that set off a recession? Questions a lot to ponder with Patty Hirsch. She is editor of the NPR podcast, The Indicator from Planet Money. His book, Man Versus Markets, Economics Explained, Plain and Simple, breaks down our financial system. He also writes historical fiction with a Wall Street twist. His second novel, Hudson's Kill, comes out in September. And he joins us from NPR West in Culver City, California this morning. Patty, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's lovely to be back here, Kate. Thanks for having me.
So oil, the U.S. producing about 12 million barrels of crude every day, making us the biggest producer over Saudi Arabia and Russia. How significant is this?
Well, it's pretty significant because it puts the U.S. in a very good position when it comes to energy independence, right? This is one of the big sort of calling cards of the administration has been that we can be independent in terms of our ability to produce energy. We use a lot of oil. We're the largest user in the world. And if we are able to produce it all ourselves, then we don't have to depend on foreigners. So that's a great thing, right?
And we also export a lot of oil as well, 8 million barrels a day of petroleum to 190 countries. So this is a real huge import and export for us.
It's a very big import and it's a very big export. Commodity that we produce, very big export. So it's very important to the economy, which is, of course, why everybody's looking to OPEC, which is going to meet next week, mm-hmm. to see what they're going to say about what they're going to do with their oil.
Well, help us understand what OPEC is, what it does. Who's OPEC?
So OPEC, which is the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, is a sort of a cartel. It's a bunch of these oil exporters that get together and they basically decide what they're going to do with the price of oil, essentially by saying, you know, are we going to produce the same amount? Are we going to produce more? Because we can, they almost like have spigots in their countries where they can actually produce more oil, or whether they're going to produce less oil. And depending on how much they produce, because we have a supply and demand deal going on with oil or any commodity during the world, in the world, if they produce more, then it means that prices will fall because there'll be a surplus. If they produce less, it means there'll be a demand will start to outmatch supply and you'll see prices rise. And right now, there's a debate going on in OPEC about whether or not they should continue the oil production cuts, right? They've been reducing the amount of oil that they've been producing. And there's a debate going on about whether or not they should extend those cuts, but we're still not sure. We still haven't had firm signals about what's going to happen there next week when they meet.
Well, connect oil then with, you know, this trade war with China. China is the world's top crude oil consumer and importer. So can we expect to see this trade war also affecting oil prices?
We certainly could, yes, because I mean, actually, as it happens, so China is the world's largest importer of oil, but not the largest producer. Not the largest consumer. The U.S. is still the largest consumer, but because China buys so much oil from other people, if the economy in China starts to decline, it means there's going to be less demand for oil, right? Which means that those OPEC producers are then going to decide to cut their production more and more, and that's going to, you know, in order to sort of prop the price up. Now, right now, you're seeing prices inching up slowly. I mean, they're up 11% since last week, over last week. So you are starting to see those see them rise at the moment, but they're not rising enough for OPEC, and people are also, of course, worried about the potential for tension between the US and Iran, which could destabilize things. The fact is that anything that is destabilizing, anything that puts a crimp on trade, is going to affect demand for oil, and that's going to make prices fall, and that's what OPEC is worried about.
We're breaking down economic concepts with Patty Hirsch, our trusted guide. He is editor of the NPR podcast, The Indicator, from Planet Money. What questions do you have about our financial system and how it works? Do you wonder about one tiny slice of economics, or does the entire concept make you kind of scratch your head? Ask away. Ask any question about economics. 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Patty, how is the U.S.'s oil reserves doing? How much do we keep on reserve, and how does that buffer us in a sense?
Well, we've got a lot in reserve, as I say, you know, because we're the largest producer and we're not using as much as we could. We're generating vast amounts. We actually hold, according to the last report, 293 billion barrels of recoverable resources. And that's 20 million more than Saudi Arabia does. So we're holding a lot of oil in reserve. And that's great for us because it means that, you know, if you do start to see a real shortfall because these oil producing countries at OPEC decide to cut supply, or say, for example, if there is some kind of a conflict with Iran or a huge trade war with China that really puts a crimp on production, if our supply lines from the Middle East are disrupted, it means we can always just use our own supply, right? And that's a very, very useful thing for us.
Well, let's take a look at our economy in expansion now for just about 10 years. If that trend continues through July, we'll break the record for the longest expansion in U.S. history. So how are we measuring expansion?
So we measure expansion in GDP growth, right? The amount of gross domestic product that we produce. And it means that, and that's basically the value of goods and services that we have ongoing in any one year, which means that the value of the goods and services that we are producing are actually increasing every single year and have been increasing for a decade, which is, you know, it's a remarkable streak. It's a great thing to have a period of expansion like this over 10 years. It's a real, you know, mark of recovery from the financial crisis of 2008. So it's very, very good news.
Let's bring in a call now. Mark joining us from Wauwatosa. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you doing this morning?
Doing well. What's your question?
Well, my question is the comment about the United States being the largest producer of oil at this point in time, of crude. That sounds great now, but how does that affect us from a military strategic perspective, you know, 15, 20 years down the road? Because I'm an environmental person, and it's been my, you know, I've been, by 2035, you know, the oil reserves should be, the taps are starting to dry out. So from a military strategic perspective, how does all this affect it?
Yeah, so, right, how does the U.S.'s superiority here, affect us long-term as fossil fuels start to dry up?
That's a great question, Mark. And, you know, it's not just a militarily strategic point of view. It's also from an economically strategic point of view, because if we're producing all of our own oil, if we're sitting on this vast amount of production and we're able to produce way more than anybody else right now, it brings this great feeling of self-satisfaction. And what it does is it removes the incentive to invest in alternatives. Right. And there are other countries around the world that don't produce oil or produce much less oil, and they are much more incentivized to look for alternatives to fossil fuel. And there is a danger, there's a real danger that we will fall behind the curve of innovation and manufacturing of technology that will allow us to compensate for the fact that, you know, fossil fuels will start to run out in the future. So that's a real thing. I mean, there's no, but we, you know, we were saying 10 years ago or, you know, 20 years ago, oh, all the oil is going to run out, you know, by 2010. But then, of course, we developed the ability to extract oil from shale. And
fracking
that extended our life.
Right.
Yeah, through fracking, exactly. And that extended our life for fossil fuels.
But that
is going to run out soon enough, so we have to be careful.
We are knee-deep in a fabulous economics explainer with Patty Hirsch by your side. He edits the NPR podcast, The Indicator, from Planet Money. You can join in 800-642-1234. Back for more in just a minute. Maybe hear from you on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back. We're getting the straight story on economic concepts, connecting current events to our pocketbooks. You're with us in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. How do you think the U.S. economy is doing? Are you in the market for a big item like a car? What do you wonder about what your purchase means to the broader economy and how financial systems operate? We're at 800-642-1234. We have new numbers out from the Conference Board. The Consumer Price Index is a measure of our economy, and it slipped this month after 3 consecutive months of increases. It's at its lowest point in nearly 2 years. But wait, how is this index measured? Patty Hirsch stays with us. He's a longtime economics and finance news correspondent and editor. Patty, explain for us, what is the Consumer Price Index and how it works?
So the consumer price index is basically the measurement of the value of a basket of goods, so that most households or the majority of households will be buying on a month to month or a day to day basis, and it doesn't include things like rent or mortgages, which a lot of people object to because you know that's a huge cost, but it doesn't include that. It's the sort of the stuff that you buy day to day, and it's a measurement of how that rises, that basket rises or falls over time. And that tells you, the Consumer Price Index tells you how expensive stuff is getting. It measures inflation, if you like, the value or the expense that households have to handle on a day-to-day or a week-to-week or a month-to-month basis. And of course, the Federal Reserve and economists watch this very, very closely because then they get a sense of, because they're also watching how much households are earning, so they can see, they can measure up and balance what earnings against expenditure is in any given household and what that might do to the economy.
So there's Consumer Confidence Index and Consumer Price Index. Is that the same
right.
basket full of goods?
Not at all. So
not
consumer
at all.
Confidence
okay.
is a completely different thing. So
okay.
consumer confidence is when you get organizations go out and speak to people. They basically give them a piece of paper to fill in, and it gets a sense of what those people feel about the economy. You know, how much are they spending? Are they looking to spend on something large in the future? Do they feel confident about buying a new car or perhaps buying a new washing machine or something like that? So it's a gauge of people's feelings about their own economic status and the status of the economy at any given time. And that, again, of course, is tracked over time so that you can get a sense of whether consumers are feeling comfortable and therefore are willing to spend more, or feeling nervous about the economy and therefore less likely to spend more, in fact, perhaps to save more or spend a lot less.
And the Indicator recently looked at this. You did a show about animal spirits. What is that term about, and how does that link up to consumer confidence?
Yes, so animal spirits was a term sort of came, that was that Maynard Keynes came up with, who was an economist, back in the 1930s, who talked about what it was that motivated people within the economy. Because if you think about it, if you were robots, if your artificial intelligence was running the economy, right, you wouldn't have any sort of knee jerk or emotional response to what was going on in the market. You'd probably say to yourself, well, for example, if you were going to buy a house, if you were a machine, you'd say, right, I have to hold this mortgage for 30 years. I have no real idea what the economy is going to do between now and then. Am I getting a good interest rate? Am I getting a bad interest rate? You know what? It's not actually worth making this risk at all. I'm not going to buy anything. So if you had robots running the economy or robots running our own personal economies, nothing would ever get done. People would never trade. They would never buy. They would never sell. The economy would sort of stagnate. And what it is that gets people to buy and sell are these animal spirits within us, excitement or fear. So, if you're excited about buying a new Volvo 240, right? I'm getting really excited about this. You go out and buy that Volvo. That's the animal spirit that's driving you to buy the Volvo. Even if in the cold light of day, you might say to yourself, maybe it's not smart to buy a Volvo 240 right now, or a Maserati or a Ferrari. And then also this fear, of course. It's like, you're in the market, you're holding Apple stock, you hear some terrible news about what's going on in China with Apple's manufacturing. You think, oh my gosh, I'm really afraid that this could affect the company badly. I'm going to sell the stock. Even though you have no real information about how the stock is, about how the company is going to perform, that fear, that animal spirit drives you to sell. So Keynes' theory was that these animal spirits are what really drives the economy. They're the underlying source that actually pushes things through the economy and makes things transact on a day-to-day basis.
So is this type of animal spirits, is it contagious? Does it spread?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, you talk about, you know, panic in the markets. That's exactly what it is. Or, you look at people, go to any January sale, all right? Go to any sort of New Year sale or Black Friday sale. And those are animal spirits working. Oh, there's people running around, grabbing all that stuff in the store. They don't need half of that stuff. If they were being coldly logical, be like, I don't really need this. I don't really need this, you know, 72-inch screen television. But the fact is that it's, because it's, you know, 50% off in the sale, you know, I've already got a television on the wall, but this one, I need this one because it's cheap and everyone else is buying it. And if I don't get it, somebody else will. Animal spirits at work.
Let's take another call now. Let's go to Jeff joining us from La Crosse. Hi, Jeff.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
Well, I'm wondering about the transfer of wealth to the 1%. What the damages of that are. Could it be corrected? If it were to be corrected, what the results would mean and so on.
Wealth, generational wealth transfer, Jeff, are you looking
well,
at?
Well, there's more and more money that is going to the 1%. The ultra rich are getting more tax breaks and the money, usually the money that they get is not put back into the economy, and it, a lot of times they just send it offshore and it becomes inactive. And, you know, what would happen if more money started coming back to the 99% and circulating?
And thanks, Jeff. What do we know about the money way, way, way at the top?
Well, we know that there's a lot of it, right? And we know that the gap between rich and poor is wide and getting wider. I mean, Jeff is absolutely right about this. And the reason for this, of course, is, or one of the main reasons for this, is that wealthy people have investments, all right? Most other people in the 99%, if you like, or the rest of us, we work for a living, all right? And we get paid a salary. And we get taxed on that salary, and that salary, and those taxes, depending on where you are, you know, are anywhere between, you know, 30% and 50%, all right, depending on which state you're in and all the rest of it. If you live off your investments, all right, and if you're a wealthy person who doesn't need to work and earn a salary, right, you've got all of this money and you put it into your investments, and your investments generate income that you live off, all right. Think about how those investments are taxed, right? You buy or sell investments, right? You're taxed at 15%, right? That's capital gains. So your income, all right, from your earnings are completely different if you're a member of the 1%, right? Than if you're a member of the rest of us, or the 99%, or the whatever percentage it is of people that are actually working adults that earn a paycheck. So it means that, you know, firstly, they're gaining more money. They're being taxed on less of it, which, of course, you know, if you apply the principle of, you know, save more, and then, you know, the more that you save, the more that you earn, you apply that principle, it means that, of course, the rich are going to get richer, and they're always going to get richer. So what would be what's the solution for that? Well, a lot of people would say, well, maybe you should tax the rich more. Or people might say, you know, you should tax those investments more. So maybe you tax the process of returns on investment more. And that is, of course, going to generate more money for the government to spend. What would happen to that money? What a great question. I have no idea. You know, there's a really good argument that governments don't actually spend money very well, right? There's a really good argument that the more money that a government has, the more likely it is that it's going to waste that money. And that, I think that's a valid argument. At the same time, we do have this issue where we do have this gap between rich and poor that is widening, and it is causing a lot of resentment. And that is what's fueling a lot of the election campaigns of a lot of the candidates for the Democratic Party this year for the presidential campaign. So it's very interesting to hear these arguments play out. And there are good reasons on both sides for keeping the status quo, because let's face it, we've had a thriving economy for the last 10 years in large part because of deregulation and the ability of wealthy people to spend more. But on the other hand, we also have this widening gap between rich and poor. So this is a debate we're going to be hearing going on for the next 4 to 5 years. It's going to be fascinating.
Well, let's swing the other direction with the federal minimum wage. It's been $7.25 an hour for a decade. Has this been sufficient for people to live on?
Well, of course, it depends on which state you're in, right? Mm-hmm. It depends on what your cost of living is in any given place. And of course, there are there are places around the country that are experimenting with larger living wages or larger minimum wages and the concept of the living wage in order to allow people to remain in those areas, usually urban areas that are generally more expensive, have higher rent costs and higher cost of living costs. And they're experimenting with those. And it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. But of course, you know, the issue is economically, in cold, hard economic terms is if you pay people more, if the minimum wage is higher, it means that companies have a more difficult time paying those people, especially the kinds of jobs that those people are in. You know, for example, restaurant work. It's, you know, restaurants are particularly, food services are particularly a difficult business to survive in, right? You know, restaurants go out of business all the time very, very quickly. If they last a year, they're lucky. And if they're, one of their largest costs is going to be staff, and if that staff cost gets higher, it means that those restaurants are less likely to survive, and that means that you're going to have less opportunity for people to hire. So that's the argument against raising the minimum wage. The other argument, of course, is that if you raise the minimum wage and it makes it more expensive for restaurants and other kinds of companies to hire, they're going to automate. And you're starting to see restaurants automate already. So they're already hiring fewer people. And that's something that's going to persist. So, again, you know, it's interesting. I sit on either side of this. I see both sides. And it's a very, very difficult conversation to have. And it is, again, one that we're going to be having a lot in the next couple of years as we come up to the next presidential campaign, I think.
Patty Hirsch stays with us. He edits The Indicator, the NPR Planet Money podcast. What questions do you have about global markets, about tech firms going public, about what private equity means? Do you have questions about commodity markets, any and all, corn, crude oil, soybeans, Minneapolis wheat? What happens in the Minneapolis Grain Exchange? Future contracts, all of it, fair game. 800-642-1234. Back for more fabulous economic lessons right here after a news update on the Ideas Network. It is Economics Plain and Simple with Patty Hirsch at our side here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Agriculture Department predicts farm debt will reach nearly $427 billion this year, the most since the farm crisis in the 80s. So what do you want to know about household debt and default rates? Is debt a good thing or a bad thing for our households, for our economy? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Patty Hirsch edits the NPR Planet Money podcast called The Indicator, and he's a longtime economics news correspondent and editor, and he stays with us. Let's go back to the phones now with Bill joining us from Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to say, he was talking about how the economy works. I'm wondering how it would be affected by a serious program for a universal basic income. He was talking about restaurants, for example, restaurant workers, and how that would affect the issues he's talking about if we did the universal basic income, because what I've heard on the program so far is just based on the assumption we have this sort of hard-edged economy without that buffer for people in it.
Hard-edged economy. Patty?
That's a very good description for the American economy. Hard-edged economy. Bill, if you don't mind, I'm going to steal that. I'm
lifting
use that.
It,
That's no, it's good.
I love it.
No, you're absolutely right. It is a hard-edged economy because there is actually relatively little safety net in this country. I mean, certainly when you compare it to countries in Europe, for example, where there are fairly significant safety nets for people who perhaps aren't earning or are out of a job or whatever, or they're ill or whatever that may be. We don't have the same kind of protections here that that they do over there. So, but Bill's asking this question about universal basic income, or UBI, and this is something that a lot of people are talking about now on the very sort of progressive side. And also, interestingly enough, on the far libertarian side of politics as well, this idea that what you would do is everybody would get a certain amount of money every month. All right. So the state, through taxes, would distribute money, just basically sort of helicopter, just drop money in front of every taxpayer, everybody, every citizen in the country, so they have a certain amount of money. So that sort of that acts as a cushion for them. Now, this has been experimented with in certain parts of the world. I think they tried it in Estonia. They've tried it in small communities in Scandinavia. And the bad news is that it hasn't really worked. What they found was that the concept is that if you give people this money, then they become less dependent on the state in the longer term, right? Because they get a bag of money, they don't need to go to the state for food stamps, for example. So you don't need to have a food stamp program, or you don't need to have a kind of a welfare program that distributes money on a need by need basis. This is just you get this money, you spend it anywhere you want to, and this does a couple of things. Firstly, it allows you to pay for basic goods during your week or your month. And secondly, it raises you out of poverty, which then deals with a whole lot of other problems, a lot of other social problems, like, you know, maybe keeps you off drugs because you've got this money, you can now you know feel better about yourself. You do have the capacity to actually earn or to do things independently rather than depend on other people. It means that it gives you a bridge to getting a job if you don't have a job. And if you do have a job, it means you can spend it on things that are going to actually help the economy and actually are going to presumably be useful both for yourself and for the economy. So the concept is that it was this whole sort of cycle of benefits. The downside, of course, is that when they've tried this in the real world, enough people tended to fritter this money away, and it didn't do what it was supposed to do. It didn't bring people up out of poverty. It didn't boost their self-esteem. It didn't make them feel, didn't actually benefit them in the world as a whole, and actually didn't reduce their reliance on an individual government. So those small experiments haven't really worked out that well, but people are still tinkering with the idea and people still like the idea. So it's a conversation that we're going to be hearing more of, no doubt about it.
Interesting. Thanks, Bill. Let's go on to Anne joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Anne.
Hi. I would like to know how our GDP economic growth is comparing with our measures of actual human well-being in the United States.
Huh. So hard numbers, GDP growth, and more the softer side of things, real human well-being.
Real human well-being. Well, perhaps that would be, I don't know, maybe the happiness index. Is that the kind of thing we're thinking about, Anne? I mean, there's certainly no doubt that, you know, the U.S. is doing...
of mental health issues and suicides, and we've got the opioid epidemic. So we've got, you know, how do you, you know, if you combine that, and I know the United States doesn't do this, and I wish we would, but as far as you know, like, what's our comparison now?
Well, there's nobody that really sort of measures all of this across all of these issues that you're talking about, and they're all obviously very important issues. But let's not forget that all countries have these issues themselves. I mean, we hear a lot about our own issues. For example, the opioid epidemic is a good one, but you know, we don't hear that much about the problems in other countries, you know, that are often lauded as, you know, places of real happiness, like Denmark or the Scandinavian countries. They have their issues as well with immigration, with drugs, all those kinds of things. So they have those issues too. We just don't hear that much about them. But that said, there are measurements. There is something called the World Happiness Report, which is a publication of the United Nations Sustainable Development Solutions Network. So it's a UN measure, and they look at all sorts of things, the causes of happiness and misery in every country, and they put a ranking together. And the fact is that we fall pretty low down that ranking. Okay, the United States is 18th. Finland is at number one. Now, I'm from the United Kingdom and Ireland. Okay, neither of my countries do particularly well either. Back when I go back home, the UK is actually falls behind the US. It's 19th, whereas the Irish are 14th. Now, I personally think the Irish are pretty happy. I think they have a pretty good life.
Well, but apparently, all those pubs?
Let's not talk about the pubs. Though. They're closing those pubs. It's just the joie de vivre. It's the natural Irish ebullience and
we'll
ability to enjoy life.
Right.
Well, let me have it. Yeah. But even they're only 14th, right? So, you know, it's tough to measure. But the fact is that, you know, the US does not do that well on that measurement, which is interesting given that our economic growth is so strong. And that may be because, you know, maybe we work too hard. Maybe we're always spending way too much time at work and we don't spend much time on vacation. Certainly, We spend a lot less time on vacation than people do in Europe and in many other parts of the rest of the developed world. So maybe that has something to do with it.
Ann, thanks so much for the call. Let's go on to Jake joining us from Madison along those lines of GDP, I understand. Jake, go ahead.
Yes, I was going to ask another question about GDP as more progressive stuff starts to happen in the Democratic candidate topics. I wanted to hear a little bit more about how breaking GDP into what percent of that is coming from actual wages and what percent of that is coming from capital. And if that's a good measure to try to explain like how GDP has increased since the 70s, that we've seen massive wage expansion.
Jake, thanks so much.
That's a great question, Jake. The difference between our the growth that we get from capital gains, all right, from investment, and the growth that we get from the share of actual the work that actually workers do. And, you know, that is broken down by some people who measure this kinds of stuff, but it's a very squishy subject because there's a lot of intersection between the two. But the fact is that, you know, one of the things that we do need to pay real attention to is the gains that we get from the sugar highs that are available to us in the economy, right? So we had a great period of growth before the financial crisis of 2007, 2008, all right? And a lot of that was because we were spending a lot of money we were borrowing a lot of money and spending a lot of money that we'd borrowed, all right? So it was massive debt that we had in the economy, both in the household and the corporate economies. And you know, that kind of sugar high led us to, and combined with a lot of deregulation in the economy, led us to a point where we over-leveraged. And then when we hit a tipping point, of course, the economy collapsed. And there is, a lot of people will say that there is a danger that the same thing is happening now, right? That we are starting to see more deregulation in the economy, right? We're starting to see the Dodd-Frank Act, which was supposed to resolve all the issues that came after the financial crisis. We're starting to see that being stripped out a little bit, in fact, quite a bit. And we're starting to see companies and households borrow more and in some cases borrow more dangerously. So there is a concern that if we have, it's not so much that, you know, we have that balance of growth. The problem is that if we depend too much on the sugar high and then the sugar high goes away, then we start to see an economic collapse. So it's less about the utility between these two, the capital gains and also earnings from work, but it's the dependence on the money that brings in, especially if it comes in from borrowing. And there is a concern, as I say, that we're starting to see a return to those risky type of borrowing methods, which do generate a lot of money, but actually can actually tip back and push us over the edge into a recession again.
Talking with Patty Hirsch, the editor of the NPR podcast, The Indicator from Planet Money, gathering your questions along the way with this economics explainer. Patty, you were getting close here, as you mentioned, the Great Recession in 2008, and thinking about home ownership rates lower than it was when it peaked 15 years ago. Why do people look at home ownership as a measure of economic health, and is it still a strong measure?
It's a very important measure because if you think about it, it's one of the biggest drivers of the economy, right? These boxes that we buy and we put stuff into, all right, that's one of the main ways that we actually spend, all right? So you have corporate expenditure, right, which buys machinery and property and all the rest of it in order to operate. But then you have households which buy these boxes, these houses, and then stuff them full of, I don't know, fridges and freezers and furniture and carpets and, you know, window dressings and all the rest of it. The economics of that are huge. I mean, they're small on the individual front. Well, not so small, actually, if you bought a fridge freezer recently. But, you know, they're relatively small. But when you max it out across the economy, when you look at all of these people buying all of this stuff, it's a huge driver of the economy. And if fewer people are buying homes, because they can't get into them because they're too expensive or because those homes aren't even being built. If fewer people are buying homes, it means that fewer people are buying all the stuff that goes into homes, which means that there's less ability for us to produce those things in the United States or anywhere else. And that means that you do have this clampdown on growth. So it is a real concern that people aren't able to buy houses and fill them with stuff. Now, of course, it's not a good thing if you're able to buy houses with nothing, right? Back in the day, you know, before 2008, 2005, 2006, those days when you could put together a liar loan, you know, making up your income and just get a house with a loan from a bank that actually didn't really mean that much. That's a dangerous situation to be in, right? That's not a good way to buy a house, all right, with actually no money at all, just a big loan from the bank. But if you do have a healthy household economy, if you are able to afford the house or at least the interest payments that you'd make on the mortgage to buy that house, that is a healthy way to generate demand within the economy for buying all of this other stuff. So that is why people watch housing very, very closely to see, firstly, how individuals are doing, what the individual's economic health is, and also what the health of the economy looks like.
We clamped down so heavily after the Great Recession on those home loans. Do you see lending loosening up now, or what is it like?
We are starting to see lending loosening up. And I do feel a little bit sorry. I hate to be an apologist for the banks here, but I do feel a bit sorry for the banks in some ways, because on the one hand, we're told, wow, you shouldn't be making these crazy loans to people. But on the other hand, we hear, why aren't you making more loans to householders? Right?
But the fact is that,
betwixt and between, exactly. But the fact is that as we move towards, you know, full employment, nominally in the country, and as, you know, wages do start to rise, we are in a situation, we're getting closer to a situation where your banks are going to feel more comfortable about lending loans. And indeed, you are starting to see banks relax their standards somewhat, but not that much. And that is, of course, is a good thing, because, you know, we went to a place in 2005, 2006, where we had way too much lax lending within the system, and that led to the financial crisis of 2008. We are not seeing that lax lending now. We are starting to see an easing of lending standards, not a laxity of lending standards. And that's a good thing, because that will allow more people to actually get into homes. So, you know, it's a balance that these guys have to walk, the bankers, these men and women who are lending loans. They have to walk this balance. They've got to make sure that they find the right balance so that we don't get into a dangerous situation, and so that we do have a situation where we do have more people in homes and buying stuff that actually help the economy.
Well, let's take another call now with Jerry joining us from Brookfield. Hi, Jerry. What's on your mind?
Hi. I was wondering what the thoughts were on behind Senator Bernie Sanders' proposition of student loan forgiveness. I think the numbers I saw were like $17 trillion or something, or that order. If that were to happen, would that be net positive, net negative? What would be the kind of economic ramifications of that sort of thing? I understand that, you know, student loan, that doesn't affect everybody, but it does affect like myself, my wife, who for a large part of our loans are paying only the minimums that we can't afford, which is tight. But
may I ask how many loans you have, or what your loans are like for student loans?
Mine are federal. My wife has some federal and private, and the federal ones, you know, I can see the loan schedule on, but the private ones, they don't have that. And, you know, those are accruing daily interest on a daily basis. And each month, most of our payment goes toward just paying that interest, which, you know, doesn't do much but the principal. So, you know, you end up in a situation where you're almost paying interest indefinitely, with very little progress made on actually paying that loan off.
Hmm. Jerry, thanks so much. Patty, what do you hear?
Well, again, another one of these great debates. Again, it's a rich and poor debate. It's a people who are enfranchised against people who are disenfranchised debate. I mean, it's fascinating. I wonder if we would have ever heard arguments about paying back debt or just forgiving debt across the board, 20 years ago. Probably not, right? But now we're starting to hear it we've been hearing it for a little while now because of the fallout from the financial crisis and the link. Even though we're in a growth, the country is growing and has been growing for 10 years, there's still this lingering feeling of crushing debt that people have. And it's not just student loans. I mean, I was listening to something today about a movement that I guess was created during Occupy Wall Street that still exists, which is for the forgiveness of all debt. I'm not sure how people feel about that. I mean, there is no doubt that student debt is really holding a lot of people down in the economy. There's absolutely no doubt about it. There is no doubt that the cost of education is rising really, really fast right now, disproportionately fast to the quality of the education and the ability of the degree that you get as a result of that education to return monies or earnings in the jobs that you get afterwards, except in a very small small number of cases. And I don't know what the answer to that is. Is it, cap the amount that you should charge for a school? Is it take taxpayer money to pay off people's student debt, either in increments or as a whole? I don't know what the answer to that. I don't actually know what the effect of that would be in the economy. I mean, if you paid off everybody's debt, it would cost a huge amount of money, right? For first thing, so that's less money that you can spend on things like roads or defense or hospitals or whatever that may be. But it also means, of course, that then you release all of those people from the shackles of that debt, which presumably will allow them to spend money elsewhere in the economy. And that's what the argument is that if you pay that debt off as an economy, as a government, then you get more revenues from the spending that they generate, and you actually invigorate the economy by buying things that allow companies to produce more and hire more people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, down the line. These are experiments that nobody's done yet. Right now, it's all kind of pie in the sky. So we don't know whether or not this is real. Even when we hear people like Bernie Sanders talk about it, is this a real thing? Would this actually happen? So right now, it's a conversation. There is no doubt that student debt is a problem for people. However, let's not make the mistake of comparing student debt to household debt right back in 2005, 2006, because a lot of those comparisons are made. People say student debt is this huge overhang on the economy, similar to the household debt of 2005, 2006. That is not true. Student debt is large and is very large for a lot of people, but it does not represent the same systemic risk to the economy. So that there's no point in making that comparison. Again, this is one of these, and I say this again, this is one of these rich versus poor, enfranchised versus disenfranchised conversations that we're going to be hearing a lot of as we run up to this next presidential election.
Getting an Economics Explainer with NPR's Planet Money podcast editor Patty Hirsch by your side. You can join in 800-642-1234. Still time for you. Patty, let's get in some fun things here. Not that what we're talking about isn't
fun.
It's all fun. I take that back. So, last week Slack went public on the New York Stock Exchange. We saw earlier in the spring Lyft went public. Both of them did it their own ways. What is significant about these tech companies going public?
Well, firstly, is Slack much fun? A lot of people who use Slack now might be saying Slack's not fun at all because it means my boss can get hold of me at any time during the day. This is, of course, this messaging service that people use at work. But yes, so they used a different type of IPO. Most people use what's called an initial public offering when they're going to sell their shares to the public. In Slack and Lyft's case, they use something called a direct public offering. And the difference is that in an initial public offering, you go out with your investment banks collection of investment banks who underwrite your offering. Basically, they buy all of the shares themselves that are going to be sold, 50% or more of the company. And then they go out and they generate a huge kind of, they try and sort of gen up the market and get the animal spirits going, right? So that whenever the company actually starts selling those shares on the market or the investment bank starts selling the shares, they're going to rocket up to a huge amount, $500 a share, and then just keep going through the roof. All right. And it's all about maximizing the return on your offering. It's about getting as much money as you possibly can from that offering. In a direct public offering, you use far fewer investment banks, and the banks don't underwrite the deal, right? What they do is they help it go to market. So what they do is you go to the market with what's called a Dutch auction, and you start selling the shares through this Dutch auction. There tends to be much less kind of excitement around it. There's much less kind of hubris around it. You don't have this what they call a roadshow where you go around generating all of this excitement. You just sell it directly into the market, and then people buy, they pay whatever they want, and they haven't been sort of pre-prepped by the investment banks in the way that they were before. And the result is that usually you never really know, of course, because when you do an IPO, you can't compare it with a direct public offering.
Yeah, got to go one way.
You haven't done it.
Right.
So nobody really knows whether they make more money or less money. But the general feeling is that if you do a direct public offering, you're kind of just leaving it to the public. You're being a little bit more laissez-faire about it. You're just leaving it up to the fates. And you don't really know whether you'd make more money in an IPO. In fact, I think you probably wouldn't. And a lot of people say that as a result of this, it means that people who go to do a direct public offering probably aren't as desperate for the money, right? Lyft, they would say, or Slack, they would say, it's probably not as needy for this money. Maybe it went public like Facebook did because it had so many investors that the SEC required that it go public. So it's not like, oh, we need the money. It's like, oh, we just have to go public right now. So a lot of the time, that's the comparison made between a DPO and an IPO, is that an IPO is when you really need lots of cash, and you've got to maximize that opportunity, whereas a direct public offering is more about, we just have to sell, or we feel this is a time to sell into the market, and we're just going to do it this way and let the public decide.
Well, The Indicator had a podcast recently. Economists were looking at how temperature affects the way we work.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
What did you find there?
Well, it's very interesting is that this is the difference between men and women when it comes to temperature in the office. And it turns out that the sweet spot, or like I should say, but the different, perhaps the
ideal temperature.
Let's talk about the drama first. Most of the drama comes in between the temperature swing between 60 and 75 degrees, and that's when you see the largest effect on women between women and men. Right? Whenever it gets warmer, whenever it goes from 60 to 75 degrees, this 15 degree swing, we see a 10 to 15% increase in the performance of women when it comes to basic tasks, right? So the warmer it gets, the more effective women become, right? The colder it gets, the more effective men become, right? So as it goes down to 60 degrees, men become more effective because when it gets warmer, men are much less effective. As it gets cooler, men become more effective, women become less effective. So there's this really interesting swing, all right, between 60 and 75 degrees. And we found that, or we didn't find, but the researchers that we spoke to found on the Planet Money Indicator, the researchers that we found said that the ideal temperature in the office is a sweet 75 degrees, right? That is when you get peak performance from both men and women, or not peak performance, but the best balance of performance between men and women. Mm-hmm. I don't know, what's your thermostat set at right now?
I'm not sure, but it sounds like they're favoring women in that outcome.
Slightly, yes.
Slightly.
But you know, maybe
that
women are certainly in media companies, women are taking over the world.
It used to be too. Men would wear suits, and they were like had way more layers. But now people aren't really dressing in suits anymore.
That's true. That's true. And in fact, you'd go into offices, you know, where it sort of favored the temperature for men, and you know, women are like wrapped up in blankets and things like this. And this was the thing that inspired these researchers to do this the research to find out what the ideal temperature would be.
Oh, Patty, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Patty Hirsch.
And thanks to your listeners for such great questions.
Absolutely. Patty Hirsch, editor of the NPR podcast, The Indicator, from Planet Money. His book, Man Versus Markets, explains our financial system. He also writes historical fiction. His second novel, Hudson's Kill, comes out in September. And he joined us from NPR West in Culver City, California. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to The Ideas Network. The Morning Show is produced by Colleen Leahy, Laura Pavin, Jana Rose Schleiss, Courtney Everett, Keegan Kyle, Chris Molina, and Brianne Shasso. Lee Rayburn is our technical director, and Keely Baltina is our executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.